So to sum it all up, looking at your blood glucose doesn't directly tell you how much fuel you have left, but the glucose levels are affected by everything that's going on in your body. Like if you're smart or lucky or whatever, you can infer some important information from your glucose levels. You can see this dropped doesn't mean I'm dying, but it means something is going on.
You are listening to Trail Runner Nation, which is devoted to bringing information and inspiration for you to be a better runner and a better person.
Hey, Scott, what if you could measure your glucose in real time as you're running? Would you do it?
Boy, if I could avoid those peaks and valleys, you have me.
Well, maybe you won't want to do that. We talked to Alex Hutchinson and we learned a lot about glucose monitoring.
That right after these messages.
Hey, Scott, you've got to check out the new release Artist Series by Jonji. You know how they put the prints of different areas? Christian Gehring did the work.
He's one of us, Don. He is a passionate trail runner, and the American Trail Running Association named him one of the most under-the-radar professional trail runners, and he's also an artist.
He took the American Southwest, and we all know how beautiful that is, and put it on a pair of Jonji shorts.
And now you can, too. If you go to jonji.com, you can see those prints, you can buy those prints, and you can get 15% off by entering the code TRN15 at checkout.
Stop wearing those solid colored shorts and get something that's beautiful and wear it around.
And know that you're doing good for the environment because 2% of your sale goes to supporting clean water projects around the globe. Jonji.com, TRN15 for 15% off. Our friends at Exoskin have new gear. You always love new gear, Freeman. Now, they now have cotton t-shirts, 100% cotton t-shirts available in two colors, either black or neon green with a white logo on the front.
And if those new shirts fit anything like Exoskin toe socks, I'm in. I love those socks. You know I always get ready for long runs with Exoskin toe socks.
Exo Toes are the best toe sock on the market, and they also make regular socks. I sometimes just use their regular socks on shorter training runs during the week.
Well, if you have more than six toes, you've got to go with the regular sock style, Scott. Absolutely.
And Exoskin offers a 15% off discount for Trail Runner Nation members. You can go to exoskin.us and use the code TRN and get 15% off. Thanks for joining another edition of Trail Runner Nation. My name is Scott War.
And I'm Don Freeman.
And today we have a returning guest, one of our favorite guests, Alex Hutchinson. He's not only an avid runner and author, and he did the amazing book. I think we did like five episodes on this book. It's called Endure, Mind, Body, and the Curiously Elastic Limits of Human Performance. You can follow him on Twitter, and he also writes a column called Sweat Science. And of course, Don, all of that is going to be linked in the show notes in case you don't get that, you're running down the trail. And Alex joins us today for a very interesting conversation. He tipped us off to this subject probably 3 or 4 months ago and said he was doing an article and some studies. And he finally wrote the article, which will be linked in the show notes, and we want to dive into it.
The name of the article is The Real-Time Fuel Gauge for Endurance Athletes. It's an outside, and as Scott said, a direct link. But we're going to get kind of a preview and a chance to kind of speak to the author of this and think about what he researched, how it applies to us, and we're going to look into this new technology that will either make a big change or not. So, Alex, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Don, and thanks, Scott. I appreciate it. I always enjoy my time here.
What is this magic gauge that Don's talking about? He has me on the edge of my seat. He normally talks about these metaphorical gauges that he looks at when he's running long races and long runs, but he's talking about a specific gauge. What is this?
Yes, he's trying to bring the realm of metaphor into the realm of purchasable consumer technology, which is exactly what the company would hope you think of it as. We're talking about continuous glucose monitors. These have been around for over a decade. They've become more common in the last, let's say, 6-7 years for people with type 1 diabetes. as a way of monitoring their blood sugar. They don't have to stick a giant pin in their finger all the time and make themselves bleed to find out what their blood sugar levels are. They can have a little device that in this particular case, you can stick in different places, but the current models, you stick on the sort of back of your upper arm. It's about the size of a silver dollar, or up in Canada, we would say is a size of a loonie, or a stack of loonies, let's say three or four loonies. And it stays there for 2 weeks at a time. You can just leave it. And it's got this, it sticks into you, but it doesn't stick into your blood. It's just this tiny little hair that's only, I don't know, an eighth of an inch at most long, that it actually measures glucose from your interstitial fluid. So this is basically from in your, just under your skin, not actually into a blood vessel. And it can connect to your smartphone or whatever. And you can know at any given moment exactly how much glucose is circulating in your bloodstream, which, if you believe the hype, tells you something important about whether you have enough energy to keep running or whether you're about to fall flat on your face.
Let's get into a little bit of the logistics behind this thing. Can I knock it off? Does it hurt to put it in? Let's get that out of the way first.
Yes. So it is possible to knock it off. The designs are getting better and better. And so I first started testing this the models I was using is made by Abbott, which is one of the big medical device companies. There are others, like Dexcom is another big player in the CGM space, but Abbott makes one that is specifically designed for sport use. I tried one out starting in January. I think they've made some updates since then, in particular. So there's a company called Super Sapiens, which is kind of managing this rollout to endurance athletes, and they have the app that then tells you about your CGM. Super Sapiens now sends you, along with the actual CGM, like a patch of tape that can go over top of your arm, so that if you're a triathlete who likes swimming a lot, it's more likely to stay on. So I spoke to, for instance, to one researcher who was doing a big study in Australia with these things, and she said, yeah, the data was interesting, but we didn't get complete data. They were elite race walkers, in this case, people out there for 3-4 hours a day training, and they found that the things fell off after 8 or 9 days.
It's crazy, the amazing technology, right? And the solution is grab some tape,
wrap it around
your arm, you're good to go.
Duct tape is the new frontier in device technology. But so I wore 4 of these things, so for 2 weeks each, so for a total of 8 weeks. At no point did any of them come off. In terms of the raw logistics of it, I will say, you know, I looked online for videos of how to stick these things on, because I was, you know, maybe slightly terrified of sticking this thing onto myself, and read the instructions very carefully, and it all looks very, very easy. And then the first one I put on, you have this applicator, you hold it up to your upper arm, and you basically just kind of press a button, and it clicks in and sticks the thing to your arm and gets the little sort of hair embedded. I did that, and immediately I started bleeding all over the place. And I was doing it in my bedroom. I was like, what the heck is going on? I thought that, you know, I watched 58 videos of this, and this never happened. Apparently, so then I did further Googling, and occasionally you're just unlucky and you happen to hit a vein that's near the surface. So I bled, but you're not supposed to. And the next three I did, you know, with like paramedics standing by in the tub, ready to deal with any emergencies, and they went completely smoothly. So I think for the most part, even for someone as abjectly terrified as I am, it's actually pretty easy, pretty smooth. And it was not daunting to stick this thing on. Getting it off is actually maybe more challenging, because the adhesive is so good that when you're trying to tear it off, you're sort of somewhat worried that you're going to tear part of your upper arm off with it. But again, there are ways you can sort of learn to ease it off with a little mineral oil and things like that.
You know, what I want to recommend is people open up your article that you wrote and read through it, because it's so educational, so good. We're not going to pretend you're the Bob Siebehar or Mark Cucuzella of blood glucose and the physiology of the body, but a journalist that went out, educated himself, and applied it to this product. So we're not going to put you on the hot seat for metabolic efficiency and have that discussion. But you know a lot of stuff, because I read the article and learned a lot of stuff. So I hope people go out and look at it. Why do we want to monitor blood glucose? What is muscle glycogen? Let's put some terms around the things that you found out.
Sure. Yeah. And I appreciate you saying that, because that, for sure, this was a voyage of discovery for me too. I was learning about glucose and the various forms of glycogen and all that sort of fueling as I wrote this article. So I am reporting secondhand what I've learned over the last few months. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, let me start by saying the sales pitch for the Super Sapiens package. And they may have tweaked it, but initially it was like, it's a real-time fuel gauge for endurance athletes. Mm-hmm. And so the promise there is that you're going to have the equivalent of the gas tank on your car. It's going to tell you how much gas is in the tank. And if that way, you know that if the gas is getting low, you better, you know, take in some food or sports drink or whatever the case may be to restock your fuel gauge and you don't run low. That's how you naively might understand what a real-time fuel gauge is going to be. And it's important to understand that this is not what a glucose monitor does for you. Mm. Glucose is a fuel. It is a form of carbohydrate. It's one of the, you know, a classic ingredient in sports drinks. When you drink sports drinks, you're getting a bunch of glucose, and that glucose is going into your stomach and then into your small intestine. It's being absorbed into your bloodstream. And that's what we're measuring, the amount of glucose in your bloodstream. So it's absolutely a form of fuel. But when you go for a long run, you've got a whole bunch of different fuel tanks that operate together. And so, for example, you've got glycogen stored in your liver, and you've got and glycogen is another form of carbohydrate, and you've got glycogen stored in your muscles. And so when you're running, the first choice of fuel for your leg muscles is the glycogen that's already sitting in your leg muscles. And measuring your glucose levels doesn't tell you anything about how much glycogen is in your muscles. Mm. Now, if you use up all the glycogen in your muscles, which happens tops after maybe 90 minutes, then you're going to rely more and more on other forms of fuel. And that could be there is some fat that's being burned, fat that's stored in your muscles, also fat that's floating around in your bloodstream. But there's also glucose floating around in your bloodstream. And so let's say a couple hours into a long run, you're relying more and more on the glucose that's floating around in your bloodstream. And so the idea then would be, if that gets too low, that suggests that you've already run out of glycogen in your muscles and that you're already running low on other forms of fuel. Now, so one of the little graphs I put in the article, which I won't do us all the disservice of trying to describe verbally, but it's like, it's okay. We have four fuel tanks. You've got carbohydrates in your muscles. You've got carbohydrates in your bloodstream. You've got fat in your muscles. You've got fat in your bloodstream. What's the proportion? What's the fuel mix that you're burning when you start running? And how does that fuel mix change when you get faster, if you go faster or slower? And how does that fuel mix change after you've been out there for half an hour and a half, 2 hours? And the takeaway message from that is that when you head out the door and start running, glucose in your bloodstream is a pretty minor contributor. It's not a big deal. It's there to make sure, like, your brain needs glucose. So the amount of glucose in your bloodstream is very tightly controlled to make sure that your brain doesn't stop functioning. And so that's the running doesn't really make much of a difference when you start. But after an hour or two, glucose is getting more and more and more important, and up to the point where you might be burning like 40% glucose after, let's say, 3 hours or something like that. So to sum it all up, looking at your blood glucose doesn't directly tell you how much fuel you have left, but the glucose levels are affected by everything that's going on in your body, like including how much glycogen, you have left, how hard you're going. All these things are going to have effects on the glucose. So if you're smart or lucky or whatever, you can infer some important information from your glucose levels. You can see this dropped. That doesn't mean I'm dying, but it means something is going on. And maybe if you're well enough informed, you can draw a conclusion about whether you're in the zone, whether you need to take fuel, or we can get into this, whether maybe the real point isn't that you should avoid bonking, but that you should make sure your glucose levels are really high, and that tells you that you're ready to race well or something like that. So there's a bunch of different potential usage cases, but they're all more complicated than just, oh, I better check my gas tank, it's almost empty.
You know, that's really interesting, and I think you may have answered this question, but may be worth reiterating, because we've had many episodes talking about becoming fat adapted, being more efficient at burning fat versus glucose or glycogen. And so if you start your run and you're at low intensity, especially for us ultra runners, we're going to be running at a low intensity where if we have any kind of fat adaption, we're burning more fat than glucose. Does that mean that maybe this device is not as useful as, let's say, a 10K, 5K, half marathon, marathon runner that are running at a faster pace, higher heart rate, which means they're burning more glucose than fat.
So I would almost argue the opposite, because again, this idea that monitoring your glucose is telling you how much glucose you have, that's kind of a misnomer. Here's a little stat that I found interesting. When you go from at rest to exercise, the amount of glucose you're burning will increase by a factor of 100. So all of a sudden, you're burning a ton more glucose.
Wow.
The level of glucose in your blood, which is what a CGM measures, basically doesn't change. So that's because there's a really tight balance between how much glucose is being kicked into your blood, whether by sports drink or by coming out of taking the glycogen stores in your liver and turning them into glucose, and how much is being used up by your muscles. And so measuring glucose, it doesn't tell you how much glucose you're burning. It just it tells you something more about the balance. And so even if you're really focused on fat adaptation, your glucose, you know, the argument from people who were really focused on fat adaptation would be, this should allow your glucose levels to stay really stable, that you're not relying on glucose. And so one of the hallmarks of someone who is well fat adapted and relying mostly on fat is that glucose isn't jumping up and down. It's not dropping as you run. And then as you take a sugary gel, it's spiking up and then dropping again because insulin kicked in, and then rising because it dropped too far. And you've got all these sort of effects and counter effects happening. If you're fat adapted, what you want to see is just you're in this zone, and the glucose can be a proxy measure for how the system is working as a whole.
Yeah. So the Zach Bitters and the Michael McKnights that can run 100 miles without any carbohydrates out there, their glucose level should be just flat because they're so efficient at pulling fat and creating energy that they don't have to reach into the glucose fuel tank.
Exactly. The first place I really heard about continuous glucose monitors was from Peter Attia. He was a big booster of them, and he is a guy who was an ultra endurance like swimmer and cyclist, and also a big proponent of fat adaptation. So he was in that way, yeah, looking to see a completely stable glucose level, not to be using it as it's low, I need to top it up.
Right. Peter has a podcast, doesn't he?
Yes. Yeah, he does. Yeah. The Drive.
Yeah. So worth checking out. A lot of good knowledge with him.
I think Dr. Cucuzella has even mentioned not these continuous glucose monitors or CGMs. Got to get the acronym right. But I think at one point he was using just the thumb finger prick method with some strips, and advocating that you go out and get these little, monitors that you can get off Amazon for super cheap and just prick your finger throughout the day to see, is your blood sugar spiking or going through this stock market type up and down, or is it constantly flat and you're keeping that level at a constant rate?
As you say this, like I'm turning and looking on my desk. I have a monitor like that and a bunch of strips right beside me on my desk. I borrowed them from my dad who was pre-diabetic. I was curious about my blood sugar levels, and I had done a little bit of that. And again, going back to me as an abject coward, I really don't like the sticking. It actually does hurt. Like the hurt you get from pricking your finger, it's not huge, but it's way bigger than the hurt from the CGM. So I was, I've used those sorts of strips periodically, occasionally, just because I'm curious. The CGM is expensive and hard to interpret, but if you're curious about your blood sugar, I would say get one of those for 2 weeks, and you'll get way, way more detailed data and be able to see what happens when I eat this meal, what happens when I'm stressed, what happens when I'm tired, what happens when I run long, when I run hard, when I run short, all these sorts of things in a much more detailed way than by pricking yourself, 3 or 5 or 10 times in a day, where you're just getting these shot in the dark measurements, and you don't know, since things could be changing rapidly, you don't know what you just missed 10 minutes earlier, and it hurts.
Right. Does this device, this CGM, do you need a prescription for this, or can you go to Super Sapiens website or whatever website or Amazon and just purchase this online?
Yeah. So the current status is you need a prescription in the US. They are available without a prescription in Europe. And I can't remember if there's any other markets, but across Europe. Basically, the pandemic kind of torpedoed their launch plans because the FDA got a little busy with a few other things. So they're basically, at this stage, their application is in, I think, but they're not even FDA is not paying attention. So I doubt they'll be available till next year. Now, one thing that's maybe worth mentioning is like one of the pathways to getting this without a prescription for Super Sapiens and for Abbott is they've manufactured one that's specifically designed for sports, which means it updates more frequently than the standard ones used by people with diabetes. But it also, they have like a limit. It only measures up to a blood glucose level of 200 nanograms per deciliter or something like that. And that's not as high as you'd need. If you have diabetes, you need to be able to track much higher levels. So they've sort of artificially constrained this device to make sure it's not used as a medical device. In other words, to make sure people with diabetes don't buy this off label and use it. So there's some complexities around that. But for now, the short answer is yes, you need a prescription to get one in the United States.
And there's a path these days to be able to get a compassionate dog to fly with by going to some doctor on, you know, welovedogs.com, you know. So there's ways to get things done. There's workarounds.
Yes. If you're motivated, you won't have a ton of trouble getting your hands on one of these.
So you had a chance to wear it. Let me get into that a little bit.
Yeah.
So you put it on and you've run with it. One of the things I heard you say earlier is, you know, it monitors your glucose, but you're really burning glycogen in the muscle. And when you drain glycogen and you feel a little bit sluggish, a little bit weak, and you don't have it all there, then you start drawing down this glucose. And then we can see the glucose dropping because you're trying to replace in larger quantities this glycogen in your muscle. So we're actually, when we get a low number on glucose, like, hey, we're really trying to put things in here, I already know that. I'm sitting on a rock. And I'm saying, crap. And then I look at my indicator watch and it says low glucose. And I go, no kidding. I'm dying over here. I know this.
Not only that, but even if you didn't know that, let's say you were somewhat oblivious. That nice story is a nice story, but it's not in fact how I was what I witnessed. It's the story is way less simple. Like you tell that story, that's what should happen. The problem is, and even what one of the scientists I spoke to who is on the company's advisory board is like, yeah, we've identified 40 different factors and up to 200 that cause blood glucose to go up and down. So I'll tell you, I put it on for the first time back in January. And the very next day I was doing an interview, which was one that I considered important and was a little nervous about.
Like this one.
Yeah, exactly. It might've been this one. It might've been when last time we spoke. You could see my blood sugars. I can look at it and it's like, I think the interview was at 1:30 PM and immediately at 1:30 PM, you see my blood sugar take a big spike up and then it stays up there for like an hour. And then I hang up the phone and, or, you know, click on the Zoom or whatever, and it drops down again. So blood glucose response to stress. It's, you know, one of the classic responses or one of the key parts of the fight or flight response is you see the lion coming towards you. Mm-hmm. Your brain recognizes the threat and your body responds immediately by dumping a bunch of extra glucose into your bloodstream because it's like, you're either going to have to run or fight for your life. So you need to have all the readily available energy, the fast energy available that we can make use of. So when you're stressed, even the modern form of stress is like, well, you know, what if my microphone doesn't work on this interview? Your blood sugar goes up. And so for me, with running, I get a little bit nervous or at least a little bit like worked up and ready for hard workouts and things like that. And so my blood glucose goes up. And so what is that? Is that a response to the fact that I'm running? So I'm using up fuel. So glucose stores are going up, or is it this just that I'm kind of like, you know, I'm going for it. So it's very hard to separate out all these different reasons that glucose might go up or might go down. And so in virtually none of my runs was I able to sort of look at the glucose levels and say, ah, yes, I can understand perfectly what was happening here. And I see cause and effect. One cause and effect you can see is if you take a gel, you're going to see a spike. Mm-hmm. But in terms of in the absence of like dumping loads of glucose into your bloodstream, it's very hard to figure out exactly what's going on, even for me, in quite long efforts. Although the longer you're out there, the more likely you are going to see it drop a little bit.
So very cool that number one, that it is accurate. It's being able to show these spikes with just stress about your microphone for an interview. So pretty cool that this device, you know, props to the creator of this, that they have something sensitive enough to see what's going on. The other side of the coin is it's very complex and there are 200 things that could change this number. And for it to be as simple as sitting on a rock saying, I need a gel, it's not that simple. There's a lot of variables out there. So the jury's still out. Now, here's something I observed also from your dialogue there is, how cool is it that the body realizes that a stressful environment is happening? It prepares you for survival by dumping and increasing your glucose level to prepare you for fight or flight, for to defend yourself. And that's cool. The body is doing that at that level to protect you.
It is very cool. And it was very cool to be able to sort of see that on the screen and say, wow, that's mm-hmm. happening under this. And, you know, I say I was nervous for the interview, but it's not like I was shaking and trembling or anything. Sure. It's just I sat down under the interview and then you look back and it's like, there is a lot of stuff going on under the hood that, you know, on some level is really smart of the body. Although in this particular context, it was a sort of maladaptive that I probably didn't need surging blood sugar just to talk on the, you know, on Zoom. But
that's not the only thing, yeah. Right? There's a lot of other fight or flight reflexes that are going on. Blood pressure goes up, yeah. You know, heart rate goes up, respiration goes up, pupils dilate, all the fight or flight sympathetic activity going on for you to fight this lion. That really is just an interview. It's cool how the body gets you prepared.
It is very cool. And you know, one thing I will say is like, I suspect over the course of this interview, the general tenor of my comments will be that this is not super useful to an athlete. But I would like to say it was pretty fun. I really enjoyed like playing around with it and trying to see how different things affected it. So definitely there's a fun factor and a fascination factor to having this window on what's going on inside.
Especially for a scientist like you.
Were there any things that surprised you as you were wearing this for the 8 weeks that you had it? Did you have any, whoa, that is crazy that my blood sugar spikes like that? And then the follow-up to that is have you made any changes as a result of using the glucose monitor?
Good questions.
Yeah. So I don't think there were any huge surprises, but I guess one thing I didn't expect is, and this goes back a little bit to what I was saying about, you know, even just stress raising blood sugar levels, is when I would head out for a run, particularly a hard run, my blood sugar levels. So look, I'm not an ultra guy, right? And especially in the context of this past year where my kids were home from school, it's like my runs were, you know, 30 to 60 minutes typically. And my blood sugars levels were typically climbing during runs, especially the harder the run, the more they climbed, which is kind of a mirror image of what I had naively expected. I thought the harder I go, maybe I'll be able to really empty the tank and see what's going on. But it's no, especially when I did interval workouts, it would be like a staircase climbing, getting higher and higher and higher. And actually then during my warm down, the levels would get to their highest because I guess by that point, I'd been pushing so hard that I was burning glucose very fast. So then all the other, like the liver stores of, my liver is pumping new glucose into the system. And then I stop going hard all of a sudden and just start jogging. So it takes time for the system to ramp back down. So I'm still pumping glucose into the system, but I'm not burning it as fast anymore. So I was surprised it's like glucose goes up the harder I go. But then I did talk to some pro athletes who've used it. And one of the guys I talked to was a British half marathoner, a guy named Jake Smith. And he had an interesting story where he was trying it out last fall and he was wearing it. He paced the London Marathon last fall. And the sort of debrief he had with the company after, because it is helpful to have people tell you what your data means.
Yeah.
It's like, your levels were going down during the race. You did not have enough glucose. And he was like, yeah, I was feeling really crappy after, you know, 10 or 11 miles, which is, you know, he was only going part way, he was pacing. So he was surprised that he did not feel that he felt so crappy in the race. And they're like, yeah, your levels were low. You need to eat more carbs. Mm. So a couple of weeks later, he went to the World Half Marathon Championships. And the day before, he was like watching his glucose monitor and stuffing himself full of carbs every time the levels seemed to get low. So he was really focusing on carb loading. And then the next day, if you look at his data from the race, it's similar to me on an interview, his levels just skyrocket. In fact, right when the race starts, they go up to 200, which is as high as the meter can go. So they max out the meter and they just stay there flatlining along the top until the end of the race. So he was above the range of the meter for the entire race. And he set a new British under 23 record. He ran like just over 60 flat for a half marathon. It was one of the, like, he was 17th in the world for a guy who had been totally unheard of. Like, and it was the best race of his life. Mm. And it followed the advice that he should eat more carbs because in his last, well, it wasn't a race, but in pacing this race, his levels had been lower. And what the people at the company told me, they have a bunch of athlete ambassadors whose data they've been sort of just watching to see what does happen in elite athletes, because nobody has really looked at this before. And it's like, yeah, in competition, these guys, their levels are just through the roof. They're really close to max, which may reflect some interesting physiology. Yeah, that, you know, their levels of arousal are so high, they're in like full flight, you know, fight the lion mode the whole race. It may also reflect the fact that they're, if you're an elite marathon or an elite Ironman triathlon or whatever the case may be, you're stuffing yourself full of carbohydrates to the extent that your stomach can allow. You're already doing that. So of course your glucose levels are high. And to me, that's one of the other counter arguments for a CGM in terms of to get to your second question, do you learn anything? Do you change anything? Well, it's like the current advice, if you're a marathoner, is like 60 to 90 grams of carbohydrate an hour, which is more than most people in practice manage to choke down because their stomachs hurt or it's logistically challenging or blah, blah, blah. So their glucose levels are irrelevant. They're already taking less than they're supposed to. They're already taking as much as they can reasonably tolerate. So, you know, if the glucose level tells them to take more, well, that's also what, you know, the running magazine and their coach and everyone else told them they should be taking more. So it's like, unless they're going to listen to the glucose meter in a way that they weren't going to listen to, you know, the fine authors at Outside Magazine or whatever, which is fine. Maybe that is the case, but what does it tell? Like, how could it change anything when you're already taking as much carb as you can? The exception to that is, I think, once you get out to the ultra distances, because then it's like, well, you know, you guys can speak to this more than I can. But if you're out there running for 8 hours or 10 hours or 12 hours, you're not just stuffing your face as much as you can. You're having to manage the fueling process in a way that's going to allow you to continue running and not vomit all over the place and things like that. So in that case, it might be useful to have some sort of indicator that says, okay, you've been riding the line a little bit, but you're now getting dangerously low. You really need to take some glucose in.
What I think is interesting about your story there is that how much the brain, you spoke to the elite athletes, but how much the brain is doing up top that could have some impact on what's going on below the neck. You know, how do you take in this stressful environment? How do you prepare the day before? What are you like at the beginning of the finish line? How are you the first 25% of the race? So much of this process that's happening psychologically can affect us physiologically. And that's why it's difficult to put somebody on a treadmill and put a mask on and say, this person's going to win the race. Look how they performed here. There's a lot of race day variables that happen that's difficult to control and predict. And I guess that's why we race.
And just related to that, I mean, just one of the things you're saying made me think of like, sleep is important to performance.
Yeah.
So there's a pretty logical school of thought that says, therefore we should monitor the heck out of it. And we should wire every night, we should go to bed. We should, you know, attach a bunch of electrodes to our foreheads and measure every minute of our sleep so we can find out if we're doing this optimally. Uh-huh. And the result for a lot of people is that you're lying there with your eyes wide open thinking, oh my God, I've been lying here for 17 minutes. I'm not going to be able to get up tomorrow. And so by measuring and quantifying and attaching importance to this very important thing, we're interfering with it. And so for me, another angle that's probably worth mentioning is fueling right is important. By having a device, an app on my phone that could tell me at any given moment what my blood sugar was, it did become a bit of an obsession. And, you know, it took, you know, probably about 15 minutes for my wife to get absolutely sick with me saying, oh my God, guess what my blood sugar level is now? I just looked at that picture over there and it's shooting through the roof, you know? So it becomes a stress. And especially because look, the other thing that's, you know, sort of theme that's worth mentioning is we're talking about this in the context of sports performance, but it's when you talk about blood sugar, it's hard to not also think in the context of general health. Yeah. And like, how is this affecting my overall health? Am I going to become pre-diabetic? I can't believe I ate that cookie. What am I doing? I can't say it was very interesting again, once to have a chance to like play with this stuff, but it was also a little bit stressful and a little bit sort of demotivating or to have this app constantly telling me, you idiot, why did you eat that?
We We're going to take a quick pause from this podcast episode with Alex Hutchinson to talk about Gooders.
Have you ever noticed, Don, that the price that you spend on sunglasses, if there was a diagram, the price you pay is directly related to how quickly you lose or scratch those glasses?
Absolutely.
So why would you want to spend hundreds of dollars on a pair of sunglasses when you can spend a very economical price on some fashionable sunglasses from Gooder?
You mentioned fashionable. They're also fun, functional, and a bit irreverent because they're kicking the sunglass industry right where it counts.
You can afford to go buy two or three pair and rotate them, just like you rotate your running shoes.
And have you noticed, Scott? You look around, trail runners wear Gooders. And if you want to identify yourself as a trail runner, you slide on a pair of Gooders.
If you haven't done so already, go to our deals page at trailrunnernation.com. There's a special link there for Gooder. Use the code TRN and you can get a discount as well.
And now back to the show with Alex. I want to talk a little bit about gadgetizing our running experience and our fitness performance, but I think it would be unwise for us not to recognize the impact and benefit that this device has on general health. For the people that are out there that are suffering from type 1 or 2 diabetes, that this is a remarkable tool to help keep them healthier, safer, happier, you know, to make sure that people don't end up with the end-stage diabetic problems where they lose vision or their peripheral nervous system in their feet. This is an important tool for the people like, sounds like you and I, Alex, that don't want to poke yourself because we're cowards. This is something that's really, really important. So I don't think we should dismiss this technology. Well, it doesn't fit us perfectly, but it still has great, great resource.
So it's absolutely like it's a game changing piece of technology for people with diabetes, and mm-hmm. and you know it can be linked to an insulin pump, for example, so that it's mm-hmm. you're automatically responding instead of you know being late to the party to respond to changes in your blood sugar. Huge, huge effect with you know, I think incredibly important effects. The more difficult discussion is: does knowing your blood sugar for someone who doesn't have diabetes or pre-diabetes, does knowing your blood sugar lead to better health outcomes? And there are certainly some very, very strong proponents of the idea that yes, knowing this, knowing that you're just below the level of pre-diabetes, for example, or knowing that eating X, Y, and Z, that your particular body responds very, very strongly to that, and you should therefore avoid X, Y, and Z. There are people who would argue that's the case. Peter Attia, who I mentioned earlier, is one person who's a really, really big advocate of CGMs for general health in people without diabetes. There is an equally strong current, and in fact, probably among mainstream endocrinologists would be the dominant strain of thought. It's like, we don't really know what blood sugar is supposed to do in you know, real-time blood sugar levels in people without diabetes are supposed to be. We don't have a lot of evidence that there's no evidence that knowing your blood sugar levels changes your prognosis. It adds stress. Therefore, and there was, I think, I can't remember if it was the New England Journal of Medicine or a fairly major journal published a viewpoint from a bunch of endocrinologists recently saying this whole fad of CGMs for people who are otherwise healthy is a waste of money and just an added stress. So that's an ongoing debate. I'm certainly not going to settle it here. And I have mixed feelings about it, but it's not as clear as it is. People with diabetes, life-changing technology. People without diabetes, I would say there's two use cases, right? You wear it for 2 weeks, once every 6 months, to get a sense of how things are going. The other use case is you wear it all the time, and it becomes just like your sleep monitor and your heart rate monitor and all these other sources of data that you're constantly collecting on yourself. And different strokes for different folks, I guess. People respond to data differently, but I would certainly tend to the more intermittent use rather than the constant use.
Yeah, I'm not afraid to weigh in on that one. I'm going to jump right in and I'm going to compete with the New England Journal of Medicine, with the epidemiologists and all the other rational thinkers that really put their thoughts together in a logical process. And I'm going to agree with you that we need to at least a couple times check in to see what happens when we have that Slurpee, to see what happens when we have a payday bar, so that we change our behaviors, not to monitor our life, but to realize that, you know what, When I eat this stuff that appeals to me when I'm hungry and I want a quick jolt, I'm jolting my body in a way that it really isn't good. I think I'll make a better choice. I think just eating rationally, and if you need a device to tell you that you need to do that, then get the device. But if you just intuitively say, you know what, I think probably an apple or something similar that grows is better than a Slurpee. I think that's probably what you need to do.
And to see not only the spike, but also the drop too. I think that would be, the whole idea is to take the spike and the drop, spike in the valley, out of that glucose level and try to maintain a constant. I think that just like many of us runners, gadgets appeal to us. We like to look at data. We like to look at gadgets and try new things. You know, years ago when the heart rate monitors first came out, or even these sleep monitors came out, there was a lot to understand. There was a lot to learn from them. And maybe that's where we are with these CGMs. I think it would be fun just to try it out, and like you did, Alex, and see, you know, what is my body doing? The more you learn about your body, the more you're going to protect.
Take care of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I agree. And I just want to pick up on something you said about that, you know, the valleys are as important to avoid as the peaks.
Yeah.
One of the reasons I was most interested in trying it out is that for as long as I can remember, I've had a thing where sometimes I'll go out for a morning run and about 15 minutes into the run, I'll start feeling lightheaded. Mm. And just kind of like my legs are fine, but I'm just kind of, I feel lightheaded and it's hard to run, and it'll last for like 5 to 10 minutes, 5 to 7 minutes, something like that. I'll be feeling like, oh, I just, and then it'll clear up and my run will go on. And I realized, you know, maybe 10 years ago, there's a name for this phenomenon. It's called reactive hypoglycemia or rebound hypoglycemia. So the thinking is basically, let's say you get up in the morning and you're a little hungry. So before your run, you have a banana or you have, you know, some little snack. In response to the banana you've just eaten, your body then, so you've got some glucose surging into your blood. Your body then says, whoa, glucose is a little higher than expected. Let's get some insulin in there to lower the blood glucose. And then just after that happens, you head out for your run and your body starts using a bunch, or at least using some glucose. So now you've got two factors that are lowering your glucose. You've got the insulin, which your body secreted in response to the snack you had just before you ran. And it has a long half-life, so it's going to stick around. And then you've got the run. And those two things together make your blood sugar overshoot and drop too low. Mm. And so you get this feeling of lightheadedness because your blood sugar is too low. So I was like, I want to see how low I go during these very repeatable episodes of rebound hypoglycemia. And I want to test different things, like what can I eat? When can I eat it? What exactly is happening with my blood sugar levels? Now, the results of that curiosity are not very satisfying because two reasons. One is that right as of now, to get real-time measurements of your blood sugar, you need to carry your phone with you. They've got a wrist reader coming shortly. It hasn't yet landed. And so what I didn't realize is when you've got your phone with you, it's measuring every minute. If you leave your phone behind, it saves your value so that you can still sync it later, but it only measures every 15 minutes. So I kept going out for runs and being like, wow, my blood sugar levels sure are smooth and stable during my runs. And then it was, how come there's no spikes at all? How come it's like suspiciously smooth? Then I looked at the underlying data and it's like, oh, there's only over one dot every 15 minutes. No, so I'm missing the spikes in the valleys. Mm. So I only kind of, and I really was resistant to running with a phone. I hate running with my phone. Just, you know, I mean, I'm not talking about going for long runs, but I have a big phone and small running shorts. It just doesn't, it doesn't work. But I borrowed my younger daughter has a narwhal fanny pack, which she had to get to carry like just masks and sanitizer to school. So I started stealing that and putting my phone in and running with this pink narwhal fanny pack for the last couple of weeks to try and get real time measurements during the run. And even then it was still, I never quite got the full rebound hypoglycemia while I was testing this out, but you could definitely see like I'd go out for a run and my blood sugar would be rising and then it would drop suddenly. And so what the people at the company say, and I, you know, it seems reasonable to me, is that in a lot of cases, it's not just the level of your blood sugar. It's not like, does it drop below 55? It's how quickly is it dropping, that you will feel crappy if it's dropping rapidly, even if it's within a good range. So that was an interesting thing for me to experiment with, even though I didn't manage to, I think with a little more time, maybe I would have been able to tease out which, foods or what timing of eating. So the basically advice is either you should, eat an hour before running or right before running before your body, so your body doesn't have time to have an insulin response. But actually I knew that without the CGM. Like, so it's not like there was any new insights I was able to glean other than, oh, it's kind of interesting to see it happening.
I have two comments. Number one, Scott, we need to get Alex in touch with our friends over at Path. We need to send him a set of Path Project shorts with the big back pocket for the phone that you use all the time.
So you don't have to go out with a pink fanny pack.
Yeah, that's right.
I think it was a good look for me.
And my second comment on rebound hypoglycemia, clearly you did not read the back of the foil package that says take in 15 minutes before your run and then 45 minutes every 45 minutes after. You'll avoid that because you'll always be pounding in fresh glucose or fresh sugar.
That's exactly what I want to be doing on my morning 30-minute jog.
Well, I think they figured this out a long time ago and recognized probably trial and error that if you're going to start eating foiled sugar, you need to do it on a regular basis to avoid the natural response of the body.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, again, it's like people can say that all you want, but for some of us, like seeing it in action could be a spur to mm-hmm. to finally pay attention to those things.
Alex, do these companies that are making these CGMs, are they also offering interpretation or coaching? It seems like if I went out and bought one of these things and slammed it on the back of my arm and started looking at the app and seeing these, I could make some very possibly damaging or incorrect assumptions or interpretations. Are there people that you worked with or that these companies offer?
Yeah. So, and that's one thing, you know, when I started out in January and the app has a lot of sort of education and they have a sort of a way of asking questions and they have sort of guidance that has continued to evolve. So the app seems to get new updates every couple months and that's the biggest thing they're trying to beef up is like, what does it mean? Mm-hmm. Now, you can have 10 people explaining multivariable calculus to you. It doesn't mean that it becomes easy, right? Mm-hmm. They're working hard. And I noticed the last update, I haven't really played with it because I haven't had a sensor on in a couple months. It's like they're coming up with metrics for a workout, like what was the slope? What was the trend? What was the variability? And trying to explain what each of these four metrics mean. So instead of just looking at a bunch of spikes and trends, you're saying, oh, well, in this workout, my average was this much higher, but the slope was negative, which meant that I was decreasing towards the end, or the variability was too high, which meant that I was waiting too long to refuel. Or, you know, they're working on that, but I think it's a hard thing. There's a point at which if you simplify it too much, you're losing the information. You're not actually being useful. So again, this is as a journalist, sometimes if I had questions, I could call them up and they would put their scientific team on the phone. I know they do have like a panel. I think there are some mechanisms to ask questions, but I haven't actually checked how quick or responsive they are.
It's cool that they're getting some algorithms and watching trends and making recommendations based on big data, because that's kind of where the world goes. More data, more better. At least that's the story. But we get right back to what we've always talked about on this podcast is, you know, we have these on board already. We have ways to listen to ourselves. And if we're tuned in enough, we can be a very efficient glucose monitor and we can be very efficient heart rate, respiration, all the things, temperature, thirst. We have all these things happening. We just need to learn to listen because we get the feedback.
And those systems work very well as long as you don't do anything stupid like running for 3 hours at a time.
Yeah, that's right.
Now, there's the warning light that comes on that says you're no longer within the operating parameters for which this system was designed.
I want to hit on that because we're set up to run from the lion. A lion is going to catch us before 3 hours. We weren't meant to run 3 hours.
Yeah, yeah.
We were meant to, you know, a good 3 minutes maybe.
Well, Daniel Lieberman would say that we're set up to chase the kudu to exhaustion, and that does take hours, but that does include walking and, you know, lots of walking breaks.
And he also said there was a team of tribesmen out there chasing. So, you know, we could hand off the role.
And there was a Land Rover right behind the camera, so that's you could always drop back and get the water.
Hey, as we're closing, can we talk a little bit about gadgetizing our experience?
Are you going to make fun of me because I wear two watches when I run, Freeman?
No, but that's I'm glad you brought that up because there is a perfect example. You know, Scott's comparing GPS timing and all of these things with two watches. But we talked about putting monitors on our head for sleep. We talked about heart rate monitors for looking at our beats per minute.
Isn't there a ring now that you wear that measures some kind of health something or other?
Yeah, the Ura ring. I think it's, I can't remember what else.
Ura. From the 70s that changed colors. Yeah, I remember that.
Mood ring. I'm tired of running right now. That's what this ring says.
Are we going overboard? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, just hit on that for a second. What do you think, Alex? Are we going overboard?
I am truly, truly torn on this because I love data. I love, you know, plotting my parameters and looking for trends. I love it a little too much. So I'm definitely like, I currently, even though this isn't what I would advise other people, I don't keep a running log because I get roped into trying to make the running log pretty and, you know, getting the numbers to continually add up. And so I have an obsessive streak to my personality. And so for me, I think the gadgetization just plays into the thing that is but to one of the trends that makes running less enjoyable for me, which is putting pressure on every run. And so I consciously don't run with the GPS watch, I run with the Timex Ironman from the 90s. It's not that I don't recognize the value in some of these gadgets, and it's not that I don't recognize the fun in some of these gadgets. And every time I end up with an opportunity to play around and test a gadget, I'm like, yeah, this is great. This is fun. And I mean, just to your point about two watches. So when I decided to test the CGM, I realized I really need to have running data to compare it to. It's not enough just to say I ran 20 minutes, you know, I ran an hour that day. Look at my day. I need to know how fast was I going. I want to see what the relationship. So it's like, I need to get a GPS watch. And I ended up with two of them for a variety of reasons. And so I wore both of them for about 6 months while I was testing these things. And all my friends were like, what the hell are you doing with two watches on your hand? I was like, well, I need to, I'm not sure which one's going to provide the data I need. I still have those watches, but a month or two ago, I had stopped wearing the CGM. And I was still wearing the GPS watches, and I reached a point where I was like, yeah, I think it's time for me to take these watches off because I'm focusing on what's my pace. I'm not just going out for a run. I'm like, I'm checking out how much mileage did I get this week. And it's starting to become onerous to me. So for me personally, I think it's a danger. But it's not that I think they're bad in and of themselves. I mean, there's a different argument that if, yeah, you rely on the GPS watch, you lose the ability to sense for yourself whether you're on the edge. This is going to hurt your ability to race properly because you've lost touch. I think that's an interesting debate to have, and I think I have some sympathy for that perspective. But for me, that's not really what it's about. What it's really about is making sure I enjoy the run as much. And I think too much data for me hinders the enjoyment.
Scott, you brought up the watches, so I'm going to finish it off. Alex, at least you had a reason to wear two watches. Scott doesn't have a reason, but I want to see your tan lines, Alex. I want to see if it's true. All right, I can see on this monitor, you are true to your word. You've taken off the dual watch.
You know, that's an interesting thing. I can't imagine, Alex, and you're inspiring me here. I can't imagine going out for a run not being able to look down and see how far I've gone and have that GPS say, hey, I'm 3 miles into a 6 mile run and now it's time to turn around. Even though I know the routes that I normally run, if I get to this point, it's 3 miles, but I still have to have that thing on my wrist and the security blanket, if you will, to look down and go, oh, I'm 2.9, I'm 2.8 miles or whatever.
That's interesting. So I think it's possible for me because I'm living in the house that I grew up in, where I first started running as a high schooler. So I've got, you know, 30 years of experience with every running route around here. I know they used to paint split. They used to have painted kilometer splits along the river near me. Those disappeared 20 years ago, but I can still tell you exactly which blade of grass is next to the 7K mark or whatever. So in a different context, and especially if I was going long, like I go to a hotel in a different city. You know, if I'm going out for a half hour run, I don't care. I don't need to know how long it is. But yeah, if I'm going out for a 20K run or a 30K run or something, 16 mile or 20
we
mile.
We understand
whatever,
you.
That's a different scenario. And I think I would consider strapping on the watch for that kind of thing. It's considering what is the purpose of the technology on this given day and using it then and not having it as the default. For me, again, I mean, as my wife my wife loves this story. I used to like eating spoon-sized shredded wheat with sliced bananas. And because it was delicious, great combination. But eventually it got too stressful because I would get to the point, it's like, am I going to have the right number of bananas, banana slices for the spoonful, spoon-sized shredded wheat so that I finish with the, one banana, one spoon sized shredded wheat for the last 10. So I stopped eating that because it was just too, I was trying to optimize it too much. And so that's my personality. And so take that as an example of, that's why I can't have constant data on my runs, because then I'll be like trying to, you know, run my progression run in like 5 minutes, 4:55, exactly. 4:50, 4:45. You know, it's too much for me, but that's, there may be other more sane people in the world.
I tell myself how well I'm doing by looking at my watch instead of internally, how am I feeling? And that's not a good thing. That's not a good thing. Letting the data decide instead of my feelings.
We need a different guest for both of you for this conversation. We've got to figure that out. And I think it'd be a nice intervention to have. Hey, I want to ask you this question about PEDs, performance enhancing drugs. Is this a performance enhancing device? Is it a PED and considered, something that we should exclude from racing?
So the UCI, the world governing body for cycling, banned CGMs in competition. So the Tour, you can't wear them during the Tour de France, even though Super Sapiens sponsors a couple of pro cycling teams. Those teams can use them in training, but not in competition. The implicit premise of that ban is that using them would offer an advantage. I don't think they've shown that. So I think they're just banning it sort of proactively, because it becomes much harder to ban something once it's already established in the peloton. I think it has, in the same way that power meters in cycling are pretty clearly an advantage, when you're talking about these 3, 4, 5 hour stages and the ability to pace yourself just perfectly, there's the potential that a CGM could offer that sort of benefit. But to me, I come back to this idea of like, really? The cycling team in the Tour de France doesn't know you're supposed to take a gel now and then? Like it's at the margins. If it's not like steroids, it's if there's an advantage, it's very, very subtle and has to be supported by a whole bunch of knowledge and, like, you know, ideally a team of technicians saying, okay, rider number 7 is looking a little low. We need to get him a bottle ASAP. Rider number 5 looks great. So tell him he can, you know, make an attack now or whatever. It's harder for me to imagine it being performance enhancing for me on my own, for example.
Well, if the Tour de France has outlawed them, it's a great marketing strategy for Sapiens. Yeah, it's like, hey, exactly. They can't use them because it's so powerful.
I remember there was a basketball shoe about 10 years ago, a sort of rival upstart basketball shoe company. It was actually founded by the kids of the guy who invented the Reebok pump. But their shtick was, it's banned by the NBA. And we're like, how? So I was writing, people that were asking, like, how do these shoes enhance jump height so much? You know, that they got banned by the NBA. And the background of the story was, it's like they called the NBA and said, hey, if we have a shoe that would, you know, make people jump 6 inches higher, would it be banned? And the NBA was like, yeah. Yeah. And they're like, okay, this shoe's banned. It's like, but you haven't shown that it makes you jump 6 inches higher. So yeah, absolutely. And there was a running shoe, Spira, spring loaded running shoes back in the 2007, 2008 or something, where it was banned. And the company paid a couple runners to run the Boston Marathon and lead it. So even though they wouldn't be allowed, if they had won, nothing, they wouldn't have been able to keep their money because the shoes were banned, or supposedly banned, just to get sort of press time. Like, these guys are so good. They're leading the Boston Marathon in a banned shoe, and you can buy this shoe at such and such a place.
Well, coincidentally, Adidas just had an athlete that was their win was disqualified because the stack height of this new Adidas shoe was over the limit at over 40 millimeters in limit. And so the winner was take the trophy or the medal was taken and away.
That's a can of worms. We'll have to have a whole separate podcast about the whole shoe technology, babe.
And I want to, but here's the first thing, Alex, that I thought about. I go, maybe I need a pair of Adidas. Maybe I need to go buy that shoe. That's the first thought that came to my mind. It's brilliant marketing.
People have noticed that race was Adidas sponsored, and he was banned for wearing an Adidas shoe. And it's like, was the fix in? Was this allowed? It doesn't seem likely, but it is interesting, and it does herald the dawn of a new era where people lose their you know, disqualified from races because their shoe was 1 centimeter too thick.
let's keep that for a drop bag or a grab bag podcast down the road, because I would love to open up that can of worms.
Alex, we always enjoy having you on, and I get into my inbox. How do we get on your email list to find all the articles that you see that are interesting, that you break down in a way that we can understand? Back to your book, the title is long and difficult for me to always remember, but I know what it looks like on the cover, and I know who's written it, and it's Alex Hutchinson. And you just go through all the various topics that we're all curious about, bring in the latest research, and then bring it down to a level where lay people like us can understand it. And we love it. We love the book. We love the opportunity to talk with you.
I appreciate the kind words, and I do appreciate the chance to chew the fat.
Do you know the name of that book? It's Endurance. Help me out.
He wrote the title.
I know.
Yeah, I have a vague memory. I think it was called Endure, Mind, Body, and the Curiously Elastic Limits of Human Performance. And I seem to recall it's available at fine bookstores everywhere.
Yeah, there you go.
Nice.
Or on our bookshelf, because we each have a copy of it and love it.
It may be the only running book that I've actually read more than once. It's that good.
Wow. That's high praise.
And I'm not just saying that because Alex is still listening.
And there's not even many pictures, very few pictures in it. So that's not.
That's why I had to read it twice.
And in fact, we did an episode. We brought in, and we did like what, four episodes on each person. Took a chapter and broke it down. This is before we even met Alex. And we thought, I wonder if he would come on and even talk to us. We've torn apart his book in a positive way. We should see if he'll talk to us. And it turns out that you're one of the very finest guests that we've had.
And comes on to stupid episodes like Drop Bag with us. I don't understand.
Right. And anyone who reads my book twice has a golden ticket as far as I'm concerned.
So go out and run
Moss. Hey, Scott, a trail race doesn't happen on its own, and a podcast doesn't happen on its own either.
No, we need to thank all those that provide and help us produce this good content. We want to thank the Patreon supporters. We really appreciate your contributions, the small aid that you make every month to help us improve on what we're trying to do here. We want to give special thanks to our business Patreon member, Doug Crumley, with Ameriprise.
Think of Doug as your pacer or crew for your finances, because he will take care of you.
You can find him at Doug Crumley Jr., DougCrumleyJr.com. We want to thank our producer, Doug Mayer.
We'd also like to thank sound man Ryan, who's with every episode and making sure that we're keeping on course.
And editing all of the bad stuff out, keeping the good stuff in. He's turning really all of our 3-hour podcasts into less than an hour podcast. That's 2/3 of the crap we say gets edited out.
We'd like to thank Doug Crumley, who is going to be running his first 100-mile run coming up. He's a business level Patreon member.
And a new addition is Yana Gibalova, who is our social media czar. You may be seeing some really cool social media content coming out, and she's responsible for that. Don and I don't even know how to log into those social media accounts, much less provide good content, and she's there to help us out. She's an active trail runner also, and we're glad that she's on board.